Thursday, December 27th, and this is Geek Nights. Tonight we talk about the first-person shooters.
Let's do this!
So you might be familiar with the sort of slashdot competitor dig. The way it works compared to slashdot is that instead of where slashdot, you submit a story and then, you know, the editors pick and choose what goes on the front page, dig is more democratic. You can just kind of dig something. And, you know, you submit something and everyone can see it, and if they dig it, and enough people dig it, it gets to the front page.
It's both good and bad. It has its pros and cons, and some people like slashdot, some like dig. Most people use both.
Yeah, I look at both. Usually dig's a little faster, slashdot has good comments, whatever. So I was unable to dig my own site and do things with dig, and it was because I messed up some networking configuration because it wasn't well documented at all. So I fixed it, and I tried to get on dig with an entry on my site. Now, I have a bunch of GamePro magazines, like 10 years worth. Don't ask me why. And when I was cleaning them up and getting ready to sell them on eBay, which I'm going to do soon, I noticed in one of them that there was a little, in the lab section where they talk about controllers and stuff, there was a little blurb, really tiny, about this third-party PlayStation 1 controller.
And it looked really familiar.
It looked exactly like, I don't know, a PlayStation 3 controller.
So, yeah, we found that interesting.
Yep. So I took a picture of it, and I put it on my site, and I wrote a little thing about it. And I said, you know, this is something that could get digged, or dug.
So dig dug.
Dig dug. So I dug it. And as I watched, it got more digs, and a little more digs. And then I went away, and I came back, and it had a whole pile of digs, and my blog had a whole pile of comments. And I was like, woot, fair, I got the front page of dig, I'm awesome. And yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's it? That's all you have to say about that?
Well, no, the interesting part was that when I looked at the stats, I got about 10,000 people came to the site to look at it. I got about 400 digs, and I got about 16 comments on my blog, about 50 comments on dig. And
yeah, none of those people spilled over into Geek Nights.
No, not really. And I didn't get, I got a quite a few, maybe a few hundred people subscribed to my RSS feed for my blog, which is cool. So the numbers are really like way out. It's like only about 10% of the people who come and visit will click on your RSS feed, at least of the dig population. And like out of 10,000 people, only 400 will actually click dig it.
Yeah, but a lot of, like, I use dig, I never log in, I've never dug anything. I just look at the site and see what other people have dug.
Oh, yeah, that's, if you really just want to read the news and use it the way you use Slashdot, that's all you gotta do.
Because, like, Slashdot, for the longest time, I never had an account or anything. I just went to the site every day and looked at the front page.
Dig has some hidden functions, though, that, like, if you get into it, you can do cool stuff. You just have to get into it. Like, you can dig stuff, and, like, everything you dig will go into, like, your digs, and you can undig stuff, and, yeah, it's all kind of crazy stuff going on in there.
Yeah, the thing that's really missing is the nice commentary that you get on a site like Slashdot.
Yeah, the comments on dig are, like, non-hierarchical, and there's no moderation. So you just get, like, these, it looks like a blog, and there's a bunch of people like, woot, this sucks, no dig, no dig. Random crap. It might as well be Fark.
Just one word. Now, Fark is more lucid than dig sometimes.
Sometimes.
People post freaking essays to Fark in Flame Wars.
Yeah, if dig put the comments and the moderating the way Slashdot does, but also with the Web 2.0, I think Slashdot would be pretty much useless. But for now, we still need Slashdot.
Yeah, for now. For now.
You know. But Slashdot should also, if Slashdot took a lesson from dig and they made a Web 2.0 site, and they got rid of all their stupid ads everywhere that no one likes.
Ads?
Yeah, the ones that we don't see, that we know are there.
Honestly, I always forget that Slashdot has ads, and then every now and then I use like someone else's computer and I see an ad.
That's painful.
And it startles me.
Yeah. And if, you know, they did all the stuff that Dig does, like the firing their editors and just using a democratic system, then Dig would die. So, whatever. But the point is I got Doug. And now I know the formula for getting dug and what will happen if I get dug.
Yep. So luckily, if Geek Nights gets dug, we won't probably go over our bandwidth limit right away.
Oh, no, it barely used any bandwidth and CPU. I mean, my site, the way I have it set up is so slick, it doesn't even, I could get a serious, like, pounding in the
Yeah, your
right.
site, but if 10,000 people downloaded Geek Nights suddenly without
any
warning.
Oh, the MP3 would be a problem.
Yeah, 20 megabytes times 10,000 is a lot of bandwidth.
Yeah, but that's all right. So, buddy Elliot Spitzer, the Attorney General of New York, he's going to get some more bad guys. Well, actually, he's getting the same bad guys again. You know, those record companies.
Yeah, he left him a nice Christmas gift.
The Christmas gift of...
lawsuits.
Coal. Oh, wait, no, subpoenas. Yeah, so he's kind of pissed about their price fix. Well, before he got them for CD price fixing. Now he's getting them for online, you know, iTunes price fixing. And I say, yeah, they are fixing the prices. CDs are worth nothing and music is worth nothing and they're selling it at more than nothing, which
well, it's not
the
even
price
that. His point is that he's saying that they're artificially inflating the prices to make them uniform or more than the wholesale value would be. And the RIA's response was that our prices are perfectly valid and they're perfectly varied. The price of a song on the wholesale can range from 60 to 90 cents. And Elliot said, that's not enough. That's not enough variance. It's obviously collusion.
Yep. And the other thing is, if you ever look on the, there were lots of websites, even RIA websites. There was a website made by the RIA that says, this is the breakdown of all the money you pay for a CD, right? And the number one item is marketing and advertising and all that. Is most of the cost of a CD is to pay to advertise that CD to get people to buy it. Now, I'd like to point out two things about that. Number one, the only CDs that actually get marketed are like the super, super hits. You won't see like the normal Joe Schmo's CD get marketed at all, but his CD costs the same. So when you buy Joe Schmo's CD from a record label, you're paying to advertise, you know, the freaking pop star's CD.
Now,
you're not
also
paying to advertise Joe Schmo's CD.
It's interesting that for some reason, the CDs that get advertised more get bought more.
You think?
Doesn't seem to have so much to do with the quality of the music, but it seems to have a lot to do with how much they market it.
Well, that's because the way their business model works is they can make more money selling a bunch of copies of a few CDs instead of the same number of copies total, but more CDs. So that's how they operate. But the second thing I wanted to point out is that why do they market at all? The MP3 trading is the marketing. That's what everyone's trying to tell them that they don't get. You don't need to advertise music. Just put it on the internet for free and people will discover it. And once they tell you what they're going to buy, that's what you make. Instead of telling people what to buy, let them tell you. And you can make $1 zillion just the same.
Or put out a bunch of singles from like all these different bands, whatever. See which ones get downloaded the most and then sell for a reasonable price albums from that band.
You don't have to pay for marketing. You could sell the CD for like $5. Hell, you could make a super audio CD. I'd pay $5 for a super audio CD with surround sound and shit.
Yeah.
I wouldn't pay. Maybe I'd pay $2 for a real CD, but you know. That's what you got to do. That's what everyone's been telling you to do. Oh, my God. They're so dumb. Oh, my God. And Elliot Spitzer's going to kick their ass.
Yeah, I mean, they really have no case here. And they issued a bunch of statements saying, oh, don't worry, this isn't a big deal to their stockholders. But if you actually read those statements, I'm not going to bother quoting them. Just they obviously either don't realize the trouble they're in or are trying to pretend they're not in trouble long enough to sell some stock.
Yeah. Yeah. Spitzer likes to kick people in the ass. He's great. In fact, he's probably the only politician that I actually say, yeah, go get him.
A lot of people are wondering about Elliot Spitzer because he seems to only be taking high-profile cases that'll get people riled up and get his name out there and that he's just doing this to be elected governor. But you know what? If someone has a sinister purpose and does good along the way, the good's fine and you stop them when they do the sinister.
Yep. I mean, it doesn't matter why he's doing the good. As long as he's doing it. And you know what? That's how democracy is supposed to work, is that no matter who's the representative, is that they're supposed to want to do the things that people, that their constituents want them to do so that they stay in office.
Plus,
it doesn't matter if he's just doing it to stay in office.
Or like say some guy's a pervert and he really gets off on putting money in poor boxes. Hey, he's still putting money in poor boxes. It doesn't matter why he's doing it.
Yeah, he's doing it because he gets off. It doesn't matter. He's helping the poor.
Yeah,
because
the good still happens.
In fact, politicians are supposed to do good things that their constituents want them to do only because that will get them reelected.
You know, I wouldn't mind so much if they even did bad things, but they had good intentions. It always seems that they have bad intentions and they do bad things. It's like the worst possible outcome every time.
That's how it seems.
Yeah,
I think a lot of, the problem is I think a lot of politicians genuinely believe that some of the things that you're doing, or at least the base beliefs behind what they're doing, are good and do good. The problem is they believe things that are factually incorrect.
Well, like, look at Conyers, the one who put forth the latest horrible DRM whatever legislation that we talked about a while ago. He issued a statement saying he got a lot of flack from geeks in his email, and he's mad because they accused him of taking bribes from the industry, and he said that, no, I'm doing this because it's a just cause, blah, blah, blah. And he wrote this thing about how we got to protect the rights of the artists versus the rights, and he talked about how he stands up for the artists, too, and he doesn't like the industry, but you can't just steal from him. And it looked like a well-reasoned article. But then if you look around, he accepted, like, tens of thousands of dollars from the RIAA right before he sponsored that law.
Yep.
So even if he didn't actually do it because of that donation, it looks really bad, and he probably shouldn't have accepted the donation.
See, you know, sometimes I think, yeah, okay, that's what happens. And you know what? Probably sometimes that is what happens. But also, you got to wonder, I mean, if I'm a politician, right, you don't actually talk to people. People send you donations, and it just goes into the bank. You don't actually, like, have to...
Actually, a lot of times you do talk to people. You'll have, like... special fundraising dinners.
Oh, well, yeah. But, I mean, you know, what if the RIA, if I'm a politician, like a senator, and the RIA sends me a check and it just goes right into my bank account, I might even know about it. I might not know that I accepted
actually,
money.
Actually, I learned about a problem that police had with that,
mm-hmm.
where people would put money in a police officer's account and then try to get him for bribery and stuff. And you can get bank accounts where no one can deposit money without your signature. And it's trivial to do so. Any bank will do it. So any politician who says he didn't know about money
but I mean, the people in your office would just get a pile of checks and they just stamp them all with a thing and then they
That's fine, because that's your signature.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is that you personally don't realize that you took a check from the RIA. It just went through your office.
But you know what? If that's the case, then why is the RIA giving you money if you don't even know it?
I don't know. Maybe it's because he was on their side that they gave him money. And not the other way around.
I don't know, because I looked through, and it doesn't seem like this was an issue for him until recently.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's how it is. In fact, I'm pretty sure he is sort of, you know, legally bribing whatever, but I'm just trying to say that it's not 100%. And
yeah, it's not 100%, but you know what? It's 90%.
That's for sure. All right.
Though in other non-U.S. news, Galileo.
You mean the guy who said gravity?
No, I mean the...
I meant, you know, things fall at the same speed no matter how
heavy they are.
The
European GPS.
See,
I don't know how many of you know, but GPS, you know, a global positioning system, is run by the U.S. government.
I thought it was a bunch of, like, geostationary satellites owned by all different people all
No, they're all, it's all run by the government.
Then why are there so many different systems for it?
They're not. They're all GPS. It's all the same.
It is?
Yeah.
Oh.
You can do GPS-type stuff with cell towers and, like, triangulation, but GPS, the official GPS, has a heavy hand from the government because they have the ability... One, they limit the accuracy of it to within 1 meter, usually, or 10 meters, depending. And whenever there's a war, or whenever the government of the United States decides that it doesn't want you to know for whatever reason, like, say it's about to invade a country...
Where you are...
Well, say they don't want, say, like, a lot of militaries use GPS.
Yeah.
So right before we invaded Iraq, the U.S. military put fake information in the GPS in the whole Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
So all the militaries who relied on it couldn't use it. And they reserve the right to pretty much just turn off GPS whenever they want. So Europe said, hey, that's not cool. We're going to make a better GPS that anyone can use that will never be turned off for any reason. And it'll also be more accurate and faster and more reliable.
Cool, do it.
And the United States said, fine, but we reserve the right to shoot it down if a hostile power ever uses it against us. Yeah, so the U.S.
Okay, here, this is, you know what, if I was Europe, you know what I would say? That satellite is our property. if you shoot down our satellite, we're going to shoot down all of your satellites, and we're going to shoot missiles at you, because that's a declaration of war. Period.
You realize that's not going to happen.
I know, but that's what someone with balls would say.
See, but the problem is, situations like that are what leads to world wars. That's what led to World War One and Two. It was people posturing like that, and then finally everyone just retaliated.
And you know what?
Like
you know what? In World Wars One and Two, they were fuckers. And the first time, it was a Kaiser. And you know what? Okay, whatever, but the Kaiser was kind of a fucker. And in two, it was Hitler. And Hitler was a real fucker. And he had to get rid of the fuckers. And you know what? The U.S. now is kind of a fucker.
All right, with World War II, you're spot on, but World War I don't really want to bust your balls here, but...
He wasn't... All right, the Kaiser wasn't as bad as, you know...
Which Kaiser? What are you talking about?
Wilhelm.
Yeah. World War I wasn't really started by Germany.
I know, but he was still kind of, you know, not so good.
Yeah, he wasn't the greatest guy, but mostly because he wasn't the smartest leader, not because he was terribly belligerent.
No, he wasn't really evil, but, you know, it wasn't exactly... It's kind of like Saddam. Saddam wasn't great, but he wasn't like the Ayatollah Khomeini or like those bad, bad guys, you know, but getting rid of him wasn't so bad.
But World War I basically started because of escalations in tension, just like you said.
Oh, yeah,
it
didn't start because of the Kaiser.
You don't shoot missiles just because someone shot down your satellite.
If someone shot down my satellite, I'd shoot down their satellite.
You know, well, the thing is, no one can shoot down satellites but us.
Oh.
Not easily.
We should put up a satellite that has a laser to shoot other satellites.
One, that violates international law.
No one has to know.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter, because shooting down Europe's satellites violates international law.
Well, I've read articles. Basically, the way they do it is they just have a big, heavy satellite up there that they just ram into it. So it's not really a weapon. It's just a big, heavy satellite that gets
in the
way of the other satellite.
Dude, that's going to be the future of space wars. It's just big chunks of metal with rockets on them slamming into each other. That'll be so great.
I mean, it's not something that's ever happened before. Conflict hasn't really entered space yet. But, I mean, because China and Russia are backing this Galileo system heavily and plan to use it. And if the U.S. ever enters conflict with Russia again, or with China, which... While I'm not going to be a crazy conspiracy guy and say, yeah, we're going to go to war with China, it's possible that within the next 40 years, there might be some low-scale conflict between the two powers. There's a good chance the U.S. might attack European satellite infrastructure as a part of that.
Mm. Trouble.
But at least from a geek perspective, Galileo is awesome. It is far superior to the current GPS.
You know what we should do? See, as technology gets smaller and easier and more accessible, eventually, us nerds will be able to put up our own GPSs. Because right now, it's like, before, it was computers. They were big things that only, countries had them and big companies had them, and they were huge.
Wait, you're
now,
saying
everyone's
that
got
you're
a
saying that geeks are going to be able to just put up geosynchronous orbit satellites.
Look, in 1920, if I would have told you, everyone would have had, like, five computers
Scott,
in their
house. There's a big difference from that. There's no physical space limitation to how many computers you can have in the world. No realistic one, anyway.
What if one day satellites are like the size of a pea? At the rate we're going, will
in that case, why do you even need a satellite? If you have the technology to do that, there are far better ways to send data than satellites.
Because the satellite can figure out where you are. That's the point of the satellite.
You can figure out where you are as long as you have multiple points of reference and precise timing. All the GPS is multiple points of reference and precise timing. That's all you need.
And what's the satellite for?
Because that makes it easier to give it to a large area unhindered.
Oh, see, that's the point of the yeah. Whatever.
Very leery of your ultra optimistic idea that somehow we'll be able to some geeks within our lifetimes will be able to launch geosynchronous satellites into orbit.
All right. Well, my point is that in a number of years within our lifetime, this will become irrelevant because everyone will have awesome GPS because it'll just be consumer technology.
Yeah,
as opposed to military technology.
I wonder if the U.S. will put export limitations on it like they did with encryption back in the day.
Lol.
Yeah.
Rofl. Barbecue.
So our things of the day are both videos today.
Yeah, this one that I got, I saw real early in the morning and it was mad freaky.
Yeah, like, have you ever seen Speed Grapher?
Yeah.
There's this character.
Yeah, we can make about a lot of jokes about that, but...
So apparently that character's real and is in this video.
Yeah, so it's this lady dancing, and I don't know where she's from. looks like Eastern Europe, maybe. I don't know. But she's really, really flexible. Like, perhaps the most flexible person on Earth. And she flexes in ways that make you go, whoa.
Yeah. I got a little queasy watching it because I thought about trying to do that to my body and imagining how it would break.
Yeah, like, she, like, flips her legs and puts them where her arms should be. And then it's real scary. And, like, the way, like, mostly the torso movements, because, like, it's like each, it's like she has torso joints that other people don't have.
Yeah, it's like a wave. It's all gooey. And
yeah. Yeah, it's like her vertebrae, like her spine is just like a piece of licorice or something. It's freaky. But anyway, watch the video and be amazed.
Yeah.
And be afraid.
And for my thing, basically, remember water rockets when you were a kid? You know, you take a 2-liter, you fill it with some water, you pump it up with an air pump, and then you let it fly into the air and you go, whee!
Mm-hmm.
Imagine taking like 20 of them and strapping them to your back and letting them all go at the same time.
Is that enough to get you going?
Yes. Yes, it is. As Japanese television has shown us.
Oh, those Japanese.
I guess the most hilarious thing about this video is the guy they do this to does not at any point look either amused or happy that this is happening to him.
And he's also wearing one of those little yellow hats with the plus from the Mega Man game.
Yeah, you know little Mega Man guys, they shoot at you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like those helmets.
So it's hilarious, and all I have to say is that try this at home, but don't say I told you to try it at home. Because I want to see other people attempt this.
Yeah, that would be hilarious.
And if you're going to attempt it over water.
Like this guy did.
This guy would have died if that hadn't been water. That's all I got to say.
Oh, my God. It would have been, you know, a guy dying sad, but oh, the hilarity.
Well, no, if you die in a funny way, it's Schadenfreude. If I die in a hilarious way, I expect to be on FARC with some sort of amusing tag.
What if you didn't know about FARC?
Then I'd assume that at least my friends would laugh about how I died.
Well, all right.
I mean, if I died in a funny way. Like, say, a dildo fell out of a plane and was hit by a meteorite and then flew through the house and impaled me from behind and killed me.
Wow.
That'd be kind of...
That's pretty creative.
Yeah. I'm good on the fly like that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So today is video game day. And
not too many actual new video games or anything coming down.
Yeah, I mean, there's new video games, but we're not playing any of them. I mean, there's probably a new SpongeBob game or whatever. You know?
Well, actually, there is a game I started playing the other day that hopefully we'll actually continue to play, and we can eventually do a podcast with it.
Yeah, and I downloaded Civ 2 and started playing it again, but I'd like to play it some more before I actually talk about it at length.
Yeah, I mean, I downloaded and I played it once or twice because I, you know, for the longing, but... You know,
it was mostly a nostalgia trip because I played the hell out of that game when I was in high school.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I can get out of it now. It's kind of sad.
Yeah. So we decided we're going to go through a history of first-person shooters as they relate to the two of us.
Yeah, because, you know, we're not too big into the brand new ones. Although I did play a little Counter-Strike Source the other day, but...
Yeah,
but I rebooted to Windows to check out what was happening.
I just warn you ahead of time, if we at all in this podcast sound pretentious or old school, just don't worry about it. We're old school when it comes to first-person shooters.
Yeah, like, we sound pretentious because we are. And yeah, we sound like we're being an asshole, it's because we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, we are.
But it's kind of that we played, like, we were really into first-person shooters back in the day. Mm-hmm. Not because they were inherently better, just because that's the kind of first-person shooters that we played. And the new ones aren't like that. So
the new ones suck.
Yeah. So we don't play the new ones so much. And there are a lot of reasons for that that we'll probably get into.
They're not as good as the old ones.
So we're starting right at the beginning.
Just being so.
Yeah.
All right.
Wolfenstein. I mean, there were first-person shooters before Wolfenstein. There were quite a few.
Which ones?
I've seen them. They're all
terrible. There wasn't anything. Wolfenstein 3D, as far as I know, was the first-person shooting game that was, you know...
That mattered.
It was the first one.
It was the first one.
The other ones,
played.
Like, there was Rise of the Triad, and there was another one. Those came a little bit after.
Huh?
You know, there were first-person shooters between Wolfenstein 3D and Doom, but Wolfenstein 3D was the first one that I know.
Well, there
of.
Were three-dimensional walk around from the first person and interact with things.
There were, but a lot of those were, you know, you would like push north and the guy would go north, and then you would push like turn left and the guy.
Well, I guess my point was Wolfenstein 3D was the first. Well, Wolfenstein was the first game that it started the first person genre to where it is now a genre.
Yep.
It was the first one that mattered, that anyone cares about, that might have existed, and it was pretty awesome.
It was actually really awesome.
I remember being blown away when I saw it for the first time.
First time I saw it was at this guy's. I'm not even going to talk about this guy because it's such a story, but he had a crap DOS computer, and it's playing Wolfenstein, and I was like, how do you play this? And we were playing this game by pushing the mouse. We were playing with mouse only, where you'd push the mouse forward to walk forward, pick it up, put it at the back of the mouse pad, push it forward again to move forward again. You know, one button shoots, one button's open doors.
I mean,
and, oh man!
If you've never played Wolfenstein, I recommend you don't, because it's a pretty terrible game.
No, Wolfenstein is still a great game.
It's not fun compared to modern games at all.
Well,
it's tedious. It's very difficult, but it's not difficult in a fun way.
No, I don't. I disagree. I mean, Wolfenstein 3D is just. It's not. It's a first-person shooter in that you walk around, you point at guys, and you push the button to kill them. But it's a different kind of first-person shooter. I mean, the game was more of a maze game of get the keys to open the doors and push button against the wall to open the secrets and collect the treasure to get points.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. The shooting was just, you know, it was like a maze with bad guys.
You walk into a room and there's five Nazis and they're all shooting at you. You shoot them all.
It wasn't really the skill of, you know, reflex and aiming that is present in the, you know, modern real FPSs. Because you really couldn't have that when it was fake, you know, the fake 3D that they had. Because it's really a 2D game.
Yes,
even though they call it Wolfenstein 3D.
It's beyond 2D. You can't have anything that wasn't a right angle in that game, even.
Yeah, it was pretty much just left and right and forward and back. There was no up and down.
Because honestly, while I was blown away by the graphics, like when I saw it, like, wow, it's 3D, go! Oh, I didn't even know it wasn't really 3D back then. But I didn't actually like the game so much.
See, I didn't really care about the graphics because I had seen games with better graphics than that I thought, you know, and I don't really pay attention to graphics anyway, but I just really like, you know, the finding secrets maze kind of game, and I like shooting the Nazis.
And it was popular, but it wasn't crazy popular.
No, it was pretty big. Like, the thing about Wolfenstein that actually, like, it didn't sell as many as Doom or other FPSs, you know, it wasn't crazy numbers, but it was weird because, like, my dad would have it on his work PC.
Yeah.
And, like, people I knew that, like, weren't gamers would have it, like, pirated for their DOS boxes. Or at least they would have the shareware version with one level.
Yep, you didn't see that so much with any other FPS.
Yeah, you don't, you know, you don't see... Doom wasn't on, you know, people's work PCs. That was when, you know, it was a thing the gamers did. But when it was a DOS game like that in those times, you know, it was businessmen that had, you know, PCs. It wasn't really super PC gaming yet. Wolfenstein kind of started the PC gaming, actually. Wolfenstein and Doom in between there.
Yeah.
So when Wolfenstein came out, it was really the PCs were for, you know, business people. So that's where you saw a lot of Wolfenstein action.
And then in 1993, the game that pretty much defined me as a PC gamer, Doom, came out.
Doom, 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 doom.
That game was a revolution compared to Wolfenstein.
Still, you know, not all the way there, but it was less about the mazing and more about the shooting.
And it exploded.
Exploded huge.
Everyone had the shareware. Like, everyone. I mean, for those of you who might be younger than us or older than us to the point where you skipped over this, everyone had this game. People bought new computers to play this game.
Yeah, I mean, these days, you can find, like, 100 people with PS2s, and you can't find a single game they all have. I mean, they don't even all have the stupid GTA game, you know? But, in those days, if you had a PC, it had Doom on it.
I mean, I had to hold down F5 when DOS booted, and then manually load the minimum number of drivers I needed to make Doom work, or I couldn't play it.
I had a better PC than that.
Well, then I bought 4 megabytes of RAM, and I was all good.
Oh, okay.
But Doom... Actually, there was a lot of hype before Doom came out. A lot of people were talking about it who were like, this game is going to be crazy. And apparently the original version of Doom, before they actually released it, was going to have a lot more features than Doom actually had. And they were taken out due to developmental and processing power constraints.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, like the original demo of Doom, if you fired a gun, it would deface the textures on the map.
Oh.
So there would be bullet holes, and there were supposed to be shadows and all this stuff that they took out because there's just no way it could be done back then.
Uh-huh.
And this is kind of cool, but the BFG, This is the first game the BFG, a.k.a. the Big Fucking Gun,
yep,
appeared in. And many of you who played Doom remember the BFG was kind of weird. Like, it didn't really work the way you expected it to. And I could explain in great detail how it actually worked, but you probably don't care.
Yeah, I expected it to just kill all the guys in the room because it was a giant green blob and then it exploded. But that's not what it did at all. But
well, originally, and you can find the demo of the original Doom before it was actually released if you look hard enough. I don't have it, but
it's easy to get.
And the original BFG actually fired out various colored fireballs in like a 45-degree angle and just filled the room with death.
Mm-hmm.
But that was too many sprites, and most computers couldn't handle it, and the game engine could barely handle it. So they nerfed it, and they made this really weird system where you fire the BFG. Whatever direction you were facing when you fired it is the direction from which the damage will emanate.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so if you fire, say you fire it into a room, like there's a long room, and then you turn and you run into another room. Then, in the original room, the BFG ball finally hits the wall. When it hits the wall, that triggers the damage. And then the damage will emanate from your character in the direction you were facing when you fired it into this new room, and it won't do anything in the old room.
See, that's the kind of stuff you lose with the modern FPSs. Nowadays, you push the button, a bullet comes out. Whatever the bullet hits is what happens.
Yep.
You know, this kind of cool stuff. While, granted, it doesn't make for the most immersive, perfect, awesome gaming, you know, world type things and stuff, but it's kind of this, you know, comfortable brokenness of cool quirkiness that you kind of miss sometimes.
Like in the old NES games when you could glitch the game and go into like areas that you weren't supposed to get into.
Yeah, it's just like this, you know, fun, good brokenness in games that is really missing today. And you know, if I was a super game designer, I would totally put stuff into my games on purpose.
Yeah.
At least it made it all the way to Counter-Strike, but we'll get to that.
Now, in addition to Doom just looking better and being a better game, it had two key additions that these are what really revolutionized FPS gaming.
The shotgun and the plasma cannon.
I wasn't going to say that.
Damn.
Though the plasma cannon was my gun.
Plasma cannon was also my gun. Hold that thing down, blue balls coming out everywhere. Oh, yeah. All right, so
one, network multiplayer.
Well, sort of.
Well, basically, if you were a businessman or if you had money, you might have had a computer network. I mean, most people didn't have network cards. They didn't have networking. Ethernet, most people didn't know what Ethernet was. You probably had dial-up, or in the very least, you had a modem. A lot of people back then had modems, but not dial-up. They would dial into things and do things.
Yep.
The BBS days.
That was fun.
And Doom, you could start a server where your computer would listen on the modem. Your friend would then call you, and you could play directly over your modem connection.
Mm-hmm.
I did this for hours upon hours back in the day with a couple of my friends.
We did it a few times, but not hours upon hours upon hours. And we actually did it more later with Heretic, actually, because that game was like had the items.
Yep.
And
yep.
Then we did it again with Command & Conquer Red Alert, which worked scarily well.
It also had, and I never got to play it back then, if you had an IPX network. Not IP, IPX.
Like Novell NetWare.
Yeah, if you don't know what it is, don't worry about it. No one uses it anymore. And basically, you could play four-player deathmatch. That was like the holy grail of gaming to me, and I spent much of my youth trying to do it.
Because
there were crazy softwares where you could like dial into one person, and that person had two modems, and then they dialed into someone else, and then three of you could play. We never got any of that stuff to work.
Nope. But yeah, I mean, you know, nowadays you kind of take Deathmatch for granted. Imagine if like Deathmatch was this ultra mode and only the most elite people could actually play multiplayer. It was like, whoa.
Yeah.
So while the Deathmatch, looking back on it, really wasn't so great, I mean, you just kind of walked around with a bunch of broken weapons pushing at each other. It was something that you just never been done, couldn't be done, and for it would be years and years before it was easy to do.
And if any of you ever want to play a Doom Deathmatch with me, I am not kidding when I say that I am the almighty lord and god of Doom Deathmatch.
Yeah, because, you know, so many other people have played it.
I played a lot when I was in high school and middle school.
I think you played it a lot more than, like, pretty much anyone outside of ID Software, just because people couldn't.
Yeah, well, because I got lucky. Like, I grew up in, like, we got cable modems real early just because they happened to roll them out as a test in my neighborhood. Then we got a cable modem real early, and it was fast.
Like, I didn't even know that Doom could be played multiplayer for a long time because it was hidden in the setup menu. It wasn't in the real... It wasn't an option in the game.
Because I remember I found it, and I tried to use it, and my modem originally was 2400 baud, which wasn't enough.
Not enough. I had a 14.4 modem.
So
that was good.
Bought a 33.6 modem, and
oh,
then
wow.
I could do it.
Yeah, I had a 14.4 that I could do it with, but it still wasn't very good.
I mean, this is before 56K, which was digital. This was analog all the way.
All right, so.
And the other, like that was the first thing. The other main thing that came about, this was more in 1994 when Doom 2 came out, which is just more of the same.
The double-barrel shotgun?
Yep. Nah. Well, the double-barrel shotgun was there, but modding.
I was saying double-barrel shotgun was the important thing.
People didn't really think to mod Wolfenstein when it came out.
You really couldn't.
Doom 2?
Oh, no, there were mods for Wolfenstein. I remember there was, like, a Barney mod where you could shoot Barney because you hated him so much.
Yeah.
Because that was the thing at the time. Was
but,
there
like,
was
it was a
people
novelty.
Didn't like Barney.
It wasn't like many people did it. There was no real community around it.
Yeah.
Once Doom 2 came out and utilities started appearing, like, Dehect and Wadded, those are the two I use.
I remember those one you could buy in the store to, like, modify Doom. There was a program you could buy. It was like D with an exclamation point or something like that.
There was Do, there was Windu, Wadded was what I used. The Wadded was kind of buggy. And there was Dehect. Dehect actually edited the executable itself. And this whole community of modding appeared. And people made Capture the Flag type games and Total Conversions. And whenever you play Counter-Strike or any game like that today, you know, Mega TF, Team Fortress, think back and remember, just for a second, that Doom 2 is where that all began.
Yep, I mean, if some guy hadn't decided that he wanted to add a weapon to Doom 2 and that he found out that, well, he could do that if he wanted, and he took the time to figure out this crazy, cryptic, undocumented crap and maybe even bought a program or two to get it to work, if he hadn't have done that, the only game, we wouldn't have any of those mods. The only games we'd be playing would be Half-Life 1, Half-Life 2, Half-Life Deathmatch.
Yeah.
There would be no Capture the Flag games. There would be no Plant the Bomb, Rescue the Hostage games. There would be none of that. There wouldn't be any Team Fortresses, no Two Forts, no nothing.
Plus, I gotta admit, it was easier back then just because there wasn't so much to the game. I still remember to this day everything it takes to mod Doom, the line defs and the side defs, and you have to define the sectors and then compile the sector maps and the error maps and all the stuff that makes a Doom level. And I made flamethrowers, and the funniest thing I ever made, I made a clone gun, and it shot, well, I made it with a friend of mine, and it shot a clone of you that would sit there, and if it saw anything, it would shoot at it with a plasma gun.
The Doom guy.
However, we were dumb, and we made it so basically it was this almighty god machine of death. And if you fired one, it just killed everyone. And that was the end of the death match.
Now, was the clone that came out of the clone gun capable of, you know, playing Doom, like, fully?
No, it would stand wherever it hit.
Okay, so it couldn't walk around and pick up items or anything.
Well, actually, it was really difficult to make complicated things because there was a certain number of frames of animation total in all of Doom. There was a list of them. And some of those frames happened to have actions associated with them. You could not associate an action with a frame that did not already have an action associated with it, but you could change the action associated with a frame that had an action pointer.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a limited number of active things you could do. So I made a flamethrower once, but I had to destroy the revenant, so you couldn't have a revenant monster. Stuff like that. It was real complicated and real fun.
See, I was going to say, maybe if the clone guy could get the clone gun and make a clone that would kill him, what would that, you know?
Well, my friend Ken made something funny. He made a rocket that when it explodes, it spawned three rockets.
Great.
And it crashed the game pretty handily if you ever fired it.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I wonder if that would actually work in a more powerful computer, though.
No, because the game maxes out. There were a lot of hard-coded limits in Doom. Like, I forget the number of sectors, but there's a limit to the number of sectors. And if you take the scale of the guy, maps couldn't be bigger than, like, 9 football fields at the absolute maximum.
It's pretty big, though.
It is pretty big.
All right. So, Doom 2, and then?
Yep. Now, see, the next thing, it's a revolution in terms of what games were and how FPSs worked. But it, honestly, personally, I didn't like it at all.
Well, I didn't like it because my computer couldn't really do it so much.
See, my computer could do it. It wasn't a fun game. at first, because the single player was kind of blah. But Doom was not three-dimensional. It was 2.5-dimensional.
Mm-hmm.
Quake 1.
And Duke Nukem 3D.
And yes, and Duke Nukem 3D, which came out shortly after.
That everyone forgets.
Were the first three-dimensional first-person shooters. Quake 1 was the first one.
I mean, this is where the mouse look was invented. I mean, because I kind of skipped this part for a little while, I mean, because I didn't have a great computer for a couple more years, I didn't get Quake 1 and Duke Nukem 3D right away, you know? Like, I got my computer when they had been out for, you know, some months and such. So, you know, I didn't, when I started getting the real 3D FPSs, I didn't really realize it right away because I didn't learn along with everyone else. Like, I learned Doom and Wolfenstein and everything.
Yep.
So I didn't even know to use mouse look. I was trying to control the games just the keyboard and look only left and right, and I wasn't using, like, the strafe, but I was totally messed up.
And also keep in mind that this was before OpenGL. In fact, GL Quake came out after Quake came out, and it was a way to modify Quake to use OpenGL if you happened to have an OpenGL card.
Yeah, because there was Glide in those days, which is the Voodoo thing. It was Glide, Direct3D, and OpenGL. And everyone either used Glide if they had a Voodoo card, or OpenGL otherwise.
And back when it first came out, no one had an OpenGL card right away. They were expensive as hell.
Yep. OpenGL was like, oh my god, you have a real video card. Holy crap.
I remember a friend of mine got a Matrox Mystique.
Yeah.
And I had a Creative Graphics Blaster Extreme with two X's and an extra E.
I didn't have a card that could do it until I got my TNT2, which is way late. Way late.
And there's not much I can really say about Quake 1 other than that it was a technological improvement.
Yep. I mean, Quake 1 pretty much took out most of the mazing. It took out, you know, I guess there's some key door action.
Yeah.
But most of it was just run around and shoot guys and don't get shot. And it's 3D. You have to look up and down. It's not automatic up and down.
But most importantly, multiplayer was now on the internet with IP.
Yep.
You can type in an IP address, connect to a server, and fight with people.
There was no automatic game matching, so you still had to find a game. But there were things that you could get, like Kali and Mplayer and all kinds of services that would match you up with people, you know?
Now, the thing is, I mean, even when Quake 2 came out, there was still no automatic. It wasn't until Steam that you
Half-Life 1 and Wand
that you really had the match me up with games and play.
Yep, and even then it was crappy.
I mean, back in the Quake 1, Quake 2 days, you had to go to the CLQ, the Champions League for Quake, which was actually this cool site. It's gone now, and I wish I had an archive of it, because I have a lot of...
I'm sure it's at archive.org or something, or Google Wayback Machine.
Quake servers put out a lot of data, and they set up this site where if you use the same name all the time when you played, it would just collect stats on you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a long period of time where me and two friends of mine were in the top 10 for Weapons Factory in Quake 2.
Mm.
I just thought I'd throw that in, a little gloaty moment. I was very proud of that.
Yeah, and Weapons Factory was a crazy mod with crazy weapons for Quake 2.
Yeah, because Quake 1, Mega TF, and Capture the Flag. That is when those first really appeared.
Yep.
And you realize to this day, there are hardcore people who still play Mega TF and consider it the pinnacle of first-person shooting.
Not many people, but a few.
Yes, it's a very close-knit community with which, we have a friend named Dan who I'm pretty sure is probably the best Mega TF player in the world.
Yeah, if you weren't paying attention, TF is Team Fortress, which is the original, you know, two forts, capture the flag, pick a class, go at it, you know, game.
Yeah,
mod.
All the predecessors.
Mega TF is the mega version for Quake 1.
Yep, and all the capture the flag type games nowadays have their roots in Team Fortress and Mega Team Fortress.
Mm-hmm. Team Fortress Classic for Half-Life was actually a port of the original Team Fortress from Quake 1 to the Half-Life engine, that because Valve purchased the guys who made the original Team Fortress. And we're still waiting for Team Fortress 2, which was supposed to be out 100 years ago.
Yeah, not so long as Duke Nukem Forever. But
yeah, Duke Nukem Forever was supposed to, like, if I remember correctly, was supposed to compete with Quake 2 because Duke Nukem 3D competed with Quake 1. And actually, Duke Nukem 3D was a real good game.
Yeah, I had it.
But
I only had
mostly
one gripe with it.
The reason Duke Nukem 3D didn't stick around the way Quake did is because it didn't really have the big multiplayer action. It was...
Well, it did, in fact, that it was all in the game and you could do it. It's
yep.
just that no one did it.
Yeah, and Duke Nukem 3D was really a first player, one player experience.
Yeah,
in fact, I think it's actually better than the Quake 1 one player by a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot of funny stuff, and there were a lot of, you know, other things going on and silly weapons. And
actually, I played a lot of the multiplayer, and all I have to say is the game came with bots.
Yep.
I think it was the first multiplayer first-person shooter to come with bots you could play with.
Mm-hmm.
Those bots fucking killed me. I couldn't even move. I'd spawn, they'd kill me. I'd spawn, they'd kill me.
Yep.
Those bots, if you ever find this game, play against the bots.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So people actually, you know, like Duke Nukem 3D, and when Quake 2 was going to come out, people were like, hey, where's the Duke Nukem 3D that's supposed to compete with it? And it didn't come.
They said it was coming.
Yeah.
They said it was coming for all these years.
And that's what Duke Nukem Forever is all about, is that's the game that never came out, and supposedly they're still working on, and we're still waiting for it.
Because Quake came out in 1994. It's now 2006 almost. Yeah.
12 years?
Yeah.
Great.
And 1996, sorry, I can't read my own handwriting.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
10
Doom
years.
Doom was 1993, Doom 2 was 94, Quake was 96, Quake 2 was 97.
All right, so we've been waiting almost 10 years, if not 10 years, for this game, and it's still not out yet.
Yep.
Now, games usually take 2 to 3 years to make, not 10.
But Quake 2, which came out after Quake 1, mm-hmm. is considered by many people, definitely not most people, but a large number of people, not just us, to be the golden age of first-person shooters.
I wouldn't say it's the golden age of first-person shooters, but I would say that Quake 2 was pretty much like the first complete FPS. I mean, Quake 1 had some problems. Everyone knows Quake 1 had some problems. Quake 2 pretty much solved all the problems, and it was just an FPS.
It was modded to an extent that I don't think any game has been modded since.
Yeah, at least with playable
mods. In terms of quantity of playable mods.
Maybe Half-Life might beat it out, but it's a tough call.
I think Half-Life beats it out in some quality nowadays, but there were thousands of mods.
Yeah, there are thousands of Half-Life mods. It's just so hard to get them and stuff. I don't know. But anyway, Quake 2 had crazy modding. It had crazy everything. And every first-person shooter since really hasn't added that much since Quake 2. It mostly graphics have been added and stuff, but
you know Counter-Strike, you like Counter-Strike. The first game like that was popular was Action Quake, which was a mod for Quake 2.
Mm-hmm.
Which actually was fantastic, and I loved it to no end.
Action Quake was very good. If you don't have Quake or it's too hard for you to get Action Quake working, you can get Action Half-Life, actually, and you could run that on Steam if you know what's going on.
But the thing is, like, we played Weapons Factory and Action Quake 2 and all that, and Lithium Deathmatch incessantly. And Quake 3 was on the horizon, and we couldn't wait. Like, we thought, it's going to be 1,000 times better. This, oh my god, oh my god, oh my god. Like, the hype was unimaginable.
Definitely out of control.
And then Quake 3 came out, and I bought it. And I put it in my computer, and I played it. And I was really unimpressed with the single player, but I thought, all right, they'll make the mods. And sure enough, shortly thereafter, the Weapons Factory mod came out, and an Action Quake-like mod came out, and the Weapons Factory one was done by the same people. And it was just, it wasn't the same, it was piss poor. It was just a worse game with better graphics.
Yep, Quake 3, what they did is they concentrated a whole lot on the graphics. They pretty much threw out the single player game. The single player in Quake 3 was pretty much play multiplayer with bots on different difficulty levels.
And to make it actually difficult, they made the bots cheat at the end.
Yep.
Like, really, they just cheated.
If you make the really hard difficulties in the single player Quake 3, the bots would just, you know, they'd have more ammo than they were supposed to have, or they would do things that people couldn't do, and they'd go fast, and they'd auto-aim, and God knows what. It was just dumb. But the multiplayer in Quake 3 was, you know, it was just so generic and bleh, and it was slower, I think, a lot of people
said. Yeah, like, just the movie, like, if you've ever played, like, Quake 3, it's very slow compared to Quake 2.
Mm-hmm.
And Quake 2 is about 3 times slower than the Quake 1 mods. Mega TF is so fast that if you tried to play it and you're not used to those old school games, literally, it'd just be a blur of the screen. You wouldn't know what was going on, then you'd die.
Yeah, I do think part of the reason Quake 1 was so fast is probably because it was so broken. It wasn't intended to be so crazy fast.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason Quake 3 was slower, I think, is because it made it more accessible. Like, you know, Quake 1 and Quake 2 were sort of this, You know, only super crazy people could play it. Because really, no one had a computer to play it other than crazy gamers.
Yep. Well, also, they were trying to make it look more realistic.
Yeah.
So, like, in Quake 3, when someone's feet moved, they lined up with the ground properly.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. But that, I mean, if you move the game at Quake 2 speeds, that would look silly.
Mm-hmm.
So they sacrificed gameplay for graphics, basically.
Well, we're not sure that was the trade-off they made, but they did do stuff like that. And the thing about Quake 3 was at that time is when, you know, that's when, you know, there were GeForces and stuff. And, you know, everyone had a computer that could kind of play Quake 3 at some degree. And they really want, I think they really wanted to, you know, sell this game the way Wolfenstein was, where everyone had Wolfenstein or had, you know, played it, or Doom, where everyone had Doom, you know. And so they're like, Quake 1 and Quake 2 didn't quite do it. Because Quake 2 wasn't, it was like really slow to build Quake 1. Like, it started out like with anticipation, but then it didn't explode. It kind of was like, here's Quake 1, all right. And then it kind of was like, Quake 1, Quake 1, Quake 1, Quake 1, Quake 1.
Quake 2 was just like this steady stream of awesome, 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 like just a steady stream. It never exploded. It just stayed in an exploded state for the entirety of its run.
Yeah, they wanted Quake 3 to explode, and I think the problem was they set the fuse wrong and it fizzled.
Yeah, because honestly, more people probably play Quake 2 and its mods today than play Quake 3 and its mods.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're, it's kind of scary, but every mod that was popular for all these old games, there is a hardcore group of individuals on the internet who play it regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And sadly, that's really where we stopped playing first-person shooters.
Well, no, because we played a lot of Counter-Strike.
Well, yeah, but that was before the Quake 3 era. Really.
Oh, yeah. Well, Half-Life really was the penultimate first, like, single-player. Because it was the first game that, like, the story and the action were intertwined together into one thing.
Yeah, I mean, what was Doom's story? You're a Marine, you're in hell. Go for it.
Yeah, Half-Life had a story, and it wasn't so much a maze. It was actually pretty linear. But it was this, like, sort of task completion, you know, how do I get over there, crawling through the vents type of thing that had never been done before. And every, you know, single-player FPS since is pretty much just a Half-Life clone of some sort, trying to incorporate story,
yep,
jumping.
Like, Doom 3 seemed to try to do
that. Solving physical puzzles type of thing. Yeah, Doom 3, same kind of thing.
Because you notice we really kind of went off on the Quakes, and we didn't mention Half-Life, because Half-Life is like this parallel other structure of first-person shooters at this point.
Yep.
Now, and it's just as good, it's just because the Quake era kind of ended.
Well, it's a different beast altogether.
Yeah.
I mean, that games that you play, Half-Life, you know, had mods like Counter-Strike, which, you know, isn't at all the fast-paced, run-around-shooting-guys first-person shooter. It's the walk-around-slow strategy, which is kind of like what the game Half-Life was, you know? The single-player Quake 2 was run through the level and kill all the demons that you can and get the hell out. Half-Life was, you know, proceed carefully and manage your ammunition and only shoot guys you have to and try to survive and solve all the things. And, you know, it's like these physical puzzles, not like Tomb Raider where it's like a block puzzle or whatever, but like, you know, how am I going to get over there with this thing in the way,
yep,
without dying and without using all my grenades and, you know, without, you know, falling in the pit?
Yep. Or, oh, there's a whole bunch of soldiers in that other room. Can I avoid them, or do I have to kill them?
Yeah, what would be, what, you know, is there a way I can sneak around this room and kill all the soldiers without them seeing me? You know, or how do, there's a giant alien that my weapons don't affect. What do I do to get rid of it? Yeah, Half-Life was pretty cool, but
yep. And
Counter-Strike,
I'll point out
is
that
the,
Counter-Strike, the new one, the Source one, is still pretty much the most played first-person shooter online.
As far as I can tell. I mean, I can't look at the numbers.
Yeah,
but
it used to be easy to find those numbers. It's not so easy anymore.
Yeah, but think about this. For a game that's, like, how many years old?
God.
At least.
Counter-Strike was at Beta 5 before I'd even heard of it.
Yeah, I played Beta 5 for, like, the tiniest bit amount of time, but it's at least 7 years old, if not more. Maybe 10 years old. No, probably 8 years old. I don't know. It's old, and it's still played more than, like, 90% of probably even brand-new games will come out. And everyone buys them, and everyone immediately plays them, and they still have less players than Counter-Strike has.
Because for every new game that came out, like, I'd get it and I'd play it, and then I'd always end up just playing Counter-Strike again.
Mm-hmm.
Or playing, actually, Natural Selection is not hugely popular, but it has a very loyal fan base.
Yeah, well, we'll talk, that comes way later.
We'll do a whole show on natural selection.
Yeah. The thing that made Counter-Strike so crazy was that, number one, it was the first game that really had real guns. And that kind of turned a lot of people on, was, hey, that's actually a gun that exists in the real world.
Yeah, because a lot of geeks seem to have this kind of, like, military fetish where they like pistols or weapons or Desert Eagle 5.0s.
Yep. The second thing about Counter-Strike was it had these new and interesting maps, but they eventually became, like, home. Like, 2-Fort was something that became home for everyone from Team Fortress, but it wasn't new or interesting. It was 2-Forts, you know, with a bridge and some water in between. But Dust is actually pretty interesting if you've never been on it before. And then eventually, you know, it feels like home and you know it like the back of your hand.
Yep, you know every nook and cranny, you know where everyone's going to be hiding. It's just, it's a good feeling.
And it feels really good to play on, you know, those old maps. And the real deal with Counter-Strike was the objectives and the no respawn. Because before Counter-Strike, it was just common sense. If you die in an FPS, you come back and you're trying to get the most frags. It was the only game, was kill the most guys. If you get killed, you reappear to kill more guys.
So actually, you realize that Action Quake had two modes, and one mode was exactly like Counter-Strike.
But no one ever played that mode.
Actually,
really.
That mode was played more. That's the mode I played almost exclusively.
Really?
You realize when I got Action Quake, I didn't know there was a deathmatch.
Mm.
I only knew the team game, and that's the one I played. I actually played in a clan, and I played against a lot of clans. I kind of played in a clan.
Huh. I never saw that.
It was the primary
mode. I knew there was a team mode, but I thought it was just kill the other team.
No, it was team versus team, and a lot of them were kill the other team, but they were like you'd be on two sides of a cliff, and there's a rail car between them, like suspended from wires going back and forth. Or there'd be objectives like hit the switch, or steal this briefcase, or escape from this place.
No, that's not quite this. But the thing is, in Counter-Strike, it was escape with the hostages or plant the bomb. Oh, yeah. And the don't forget the jail, which they got rid of.
Yep, ES, escape maps, and AS, assassinate maps.
Assassinate maps were my favorite, but what are you going to do? They took them out.
But also, Action Quake definitely had the, if you die, you don't respawn.
Oh, yeah. That was pretty huge, was that, you know... The dying, and then you have to watch the game until the round is over. Because in a team game, you have rounds. You know, when one team wins, you start again. It doesn't really work in a death match where people die, people come back, you know. But when you have a team game, one team wins. And the way it worked is as soon as you died, you stayed out. And I remember the first time someone told me that, I was like, what? What are you talking about? That's crap. I want to keep playing. I want to play a game like that. What are you talking about? And then I realized, oh, Counter-Strike's a free mod. I didn't quite understand at first. And I got it, and I was like, oh, I get it. And thus, I played Counter-Strike up until, I played it yesterday, the day before.
Yeah, I would have, but I discovered when I booted into Windows that the fan on the GPU of my video card is not spinning anymore.
Uh-huh.
So my computer's fine in Linux, because I don't really use the accelerated, but the moment I start an OpenGL thing, my computer crashes.
Mm.
So I got to fix that, or buy a new computer.
All right.
Probably the latter.
Well, considering we haven't played a lot of the newer FPSs, let's just fast forward. Tribes 2 is probably the best FPS ever, period.
Yeah, Tribes 2 was a fantastic fucking game.
Yep.
Oh my god, and now it's dead.
Yeah, it so sad, it. I mourn. Half-Life 2 was pretty much, it was like the same thing as Half-Life 1. You know, a great, great, awesome single player. They got this great physics engine, but it's really just like Half-Life is now upgraded. They didn't really, you know, revolutionize anything. It's just a graphical and physical upgrade to Half-Life.
Yeah, so maybe in the future, once we play more of these new games or have more to say about them, we'll do another show, a continuation. But for now, that's it. FPSs are kind of a wayward thing for us.
Yeah, I guess that's partially because of Linux and partially because PC gaming's dying in general.
Yeah, I mean, I want it to come back, and maybe if the Xbox flops or depending on what happens, but there haven't been many PC games that have excited me in a long time.
Yeah, me either. I mean,
I'm more excited by Counter-Strike than I am about any game that's come out, with the possible exception of Civ 4.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the PC's going mostly to MMOs, and there's still some FPSs, like that Battlefield 2 came out. You know, my brother said it was pretty cool, and he knows what's up, because he plays Counter. He plays the real FPSs, you know, not the Halos and things, which I'm not even going to talk about here, because they're not really PC games. But, you know, more FPSs nowadays are just graphical upgrades, not really adding anything. Maybe there'll be an MMO FPS besides Planetside that doesn't suck one day.
And that was Geek Nights with Rim and Scott. Special thanks to DJ Pretzel for the opening music.
Thanks for listening. Please remember to point your favorite podcatcher at feeds.feedburner.com/geeknights to get the latest episodes as soon as they're released. Also, please visit our website at www.frontrowcrew.com for the latest updates and forum discussions. And whether you love or hate our podcast, we won't know unless you send your feedback to us at geeknights@gmail.com.